Blog Talk Radio. It's time for Monday Night Radio. Monday night is your night to talk with the experts. Call us now to get into the queue at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. Call us now. Or email your questions and comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet them to us at Monday Radio. And now, here's your host, Ann P. Mitchell, Esquire.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Monday Night Radio. We have got such an incredible show tonight for you. I am so excited about our guest, and we will get to her in just a minute. But first, I have a couple of things to tell you. Again, I want to remind you that you can call in both to listen and to ask questions of our guest or give her your comments. And the number from anywhere in North America is 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. If you're calling from outside of North America, you can call us directly at 347-857-3122. That's 347-857-3122. Or if you want to save yourself a dime, you can drop us a comment by Twitter at Monday Radio or by email at comments@mondaynightradio.com. And also, you can listen in via Skype, and that link is on our website at mondaynightradio.com. I also want to remind you that if you'd like to get free automatic email reminders of the upcoming shows, find out in advance who's going to be on with us, and also to get notices when we post the recorded audio or the interviews, you can sign up for our newsletter, and you can do that either on the site or you can do that through our Facebook page. Hey, our Facebook page is at facebook.com/Monday Night Radio. So there are so many ways to get a hold of us to ask a question. Now, before we start, I would also like to play a comment that we received. Remember that sometimes we ask questions. We do that through our newsletter, and we love to get your comments. And this is a comment that someone gave us there, what they feel about a story having to do with the FBI tracking people by attaching GPS units to their cars, and they don't need a warrant to do that. And so we wanted to hear what people thought of that. You're welcome to also let us know what you think of that. And here we go. Here is this message that someone left us.
Yes, this is Mishman 5243 commenting on the FBI without warrant tracking with GPS. I think it's a good idea, excellent idea, especially if they're tracking someone who is engaged in a robbery or some kind of an unlawful act. To catch this person, I think it's great. I don't think it's really invasion of privacy. I think it is through the telephone, but I don't think with GPS. I think it's a great idea with the tracking for the GPS. That's just my opinion. Thank you.
So what do you think about that? The story is that the FBI is attaching GPS units to the outside of people's cars. They are not seeking a warrant first. Federal courts are split on that. Some federal courts, the one in California, which is where this most recently took place, said, hey, it's a public place. The FBI doesn't need a warrant to follow you around in public, and so there's no reason they should need a warrant to attach a GPS unit to your car out in public. Other courts have said, hey, they need a warrant that's a little more invasive. It's new technology relative to back when this was last looked at. So let us know what you think. If you want to leave us a message on our voicemail, you can do that, and we might play your message as well, your comment on the air. And you can do that also at 866-MONDAY-6, but not during the show. Or you can also email your comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com. Now, before I bring our guest on, I just want to direct your attention to our snazzy new logo. Yes, that is me. You can tell by the ever-present coffee in my hand. You can see our logo on our website at mondaynightradio.com. You can also see it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/mondaynightradio. And without further ado, let's get on to this guest. Our guest is Chaplain Andrea Rayner, and she is a chaplain. I am so sorry, Chaplain Rayner. I actually realized I don't know where you live. I was imagining you were in New York, but I don't know if that's the case. So as soon as I bring you on, you have to let us know. But she was a chaplain, among other things, at Ground Zero in the aftermath of 9/11. And so as you might be able to imagine, she has a great deal of experience helping those who are grieving after a sudden, unexpected, incredibly tragic and shocking death. She also has experience, though, helping those who are dealing with the process of a loved one dying through a long, slow illness. And so as you can imagine, certainly there are commonalities when you're trying to support people who are dealing with these issues. But there are also differences, the difference in how you might support someone who is grieving and also in shock, and someone who is dealing with having supported someone and dealt with caring for them through a long illness. You know, there are similarities, but there are also differences. So let's bring Chaplain Rayner on and determine that. I just have to find where she is. Excuse me just a minute, because I'm looking on our switchboard, and there she is. You know, we have so many callers already waiting to talk with her that she was hidden away. Chaplain Rayner, are you there?
Hi, Ann. Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, hi, Chaplain Rayner. I am so sorry. I was looking for you on our switchboard, and you were right next to me because you had called in right on time, and suddenly the switchboard's all lit up, and I couldn't find you. Are
no
you in
problem.
New York, or are you on the
yep,
East Coast somewhere?
I'm in Rye, New York.
Okay.
And I'm just outside of Manhattan in Rye, New York.
Excellent. Well, I'm from New York originally as well, so I know where Rye is. And now, does that explain how you ended up having this incredible opportunity to sit with the survivors of 9/11?
Yeah, it was really kind of a blessing of proximity. I happened to live in Rye, very close to an Episcopal bishop to the armed forces. His name is George Packard, and our daughters were in the third grade together. So it was through Bishop Packard that I was initially commissioned to work at Ground Zero.
Okay, and do you want to, you know, this is a very sensitive subject even now, years later, and so I want to be very careful, but of course I also really want to hear about your experience, as I'm sure do our listeners. So when you talk about this, do you want to sort of just tell us what you usually sort of like to talk about?
Well, you know, what I find that people are very interested in, even these 9 years later, when it comes to my work at Ground Zero, is to understand the spiritual nature of what went on at the morgue, because I was stationed at the small temporary morgue. It was basically a little trailer which sat right on the site of Ground Zero. There were chaplains of every faith, every denomination, who were assigned different posts at the Family Center, at St. Paul's, at the Marriott, at various respite centers. My post was at the morgue. So what that work really entailed was being present as remains were brought from the site, initially being exhumed from the pile, which eventually became the pit. I think most of Americans and really people across the country watched that enormous pile of smoldering wreckage then become a very neat and tidy pit. And so when the bodies or parts of bodies were found, they were brought to our trailer, and the every part of every person was logged by hand into a giant book that had the time of the recovery, the place, the part of the body, if there was identification a crime scene officer would photograph the remains because it was a crime scene, and then a chaplain would offer a blessing over the remains. So my job was to offer the blessing and also to offer support to the workers who were on site. So that could entail listening to stories from people who were there on September 11th, or, you know, listening to the stories from people who were there day after day working to recover remains.
Wow. That just, even just hearing you talk about it, it just sounds like such a monumental and incredible place to be. How did you handle for yourself everything you were seeing, and how do you offer solace and comfort to someone when you yourself are surrounded by something of such a just an inconceivable proportion?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because if you had asked me on September 10th if I could offer blessing over basically dismembered people or charred remains, I would have said, I can't imagine doing that. And yet, like any of us, if we're called to do a task and we feel called to do that task, you somehow are given the strength to offer yourself. And so similarly, I felt called to be at the morgue as a hospice chaplain. I felt like I was more acquainted with death and probably the dead than many of my colleagues, having been at the bedside of a couple thousand people at that point who were dying or who had died. And so the other part of that, which is anyone who worked at Ground Zero could tell you, is the feeling once you were on site was this overwhelming sense of the human spirit and the incredible goodness that was present in the face of such terrible evil and such destruction. And so on the one hand, I found it very difficult to start my shift, found it very difficult to leave my kids and to get on the train and to go downtown. And I also found it very difficult to end that shift, because to leave Ground Zero also was to leave that feeling of community and vision and support that was so alive among the workers there. So, you know, it's very hard to articulate it in some ways, because the feeling was of such calling when you're on site. And yet I think it took me a number of years, it took me about 5 years really, to begin to think about those experiences and to allow the memories to come back into my mind, the things that I had seen. Because for quite some time, if I were driving along and I'd see a discarded shoe or a clump of leaves, I would think I was seeing a part of a body. And so I know that there was some trauma there. But eventually by writing about it and by sharing about it, I think that the trauma has now just become part of the fabric of my life.
Well, I really want to get to our callers again. We have many of them. And for you guys who are in the chat room hanging out there, we see you. And I'm wondering, do you see us? We're messaging you and no one's responding. And I'm guessing it might be because you're all so enthralled by what Chaplain Rayner has to say. But do give us a wave in the chat room to let us know, because, of course, you can also ask questions or make comments from the chat room as well. I just want to remind you, this is Monday Night Radio. We have Chaplain Andrea Rayner with us tonight. You can call in with your questions or comments at 866-MONDAY-6. That number works anywhere in the North American continent, 866-MONDAY-6. If you are calling from outside of North America, you can call 347-857-3122, or you can send us a comment by email to comments@mondaynightradio.com or by Twitter at Monday Radio, and also on our Facebook page at Monday Radio, Monday Night Radio at Facebook. I have just way too many internet addresses in my head. That Facebook address is facebook.com Monday Night Radio. And so, Chaplain Rayner, the one other thing I wanted to ask, this is not a show about 9/11, but obviously it's something that is still greatly in our memory and is very interesting also to us all, and just to try and imagine someone being there in your capacity. And the one thing I wanted to ask before we sort of moved on, if you don't mind, is, you know, 9/11 was carried out in the name of a certain type of group of people that are religiously affiliated. I'm trying to be really careful here because I don't think anyone here really credits any religion with doing something so heinous, but it was certainly carried out in that name. And how did you handle the questions of faith that I'm sure must have come up at that site when you were trying to help the grieving families? You know, faith is questioned anyway during times like that, but I have to imagine there was sort of an underpinning of, you know, what kind of faith would allow this to be carried out in its name. Did that come up a lot with the grieving survivors?
You would be surprised, and first of all, please call me Andy. You would be actually very surprised at the level of spirituality and faith that that was present at Ground Zero, because while this was carried, you know, while the act was carried on by people of a particular faith, I think everyone there recognized that heinous acts are performed and have been performed throughout history in the name of God, whatever, a Christian God, Muslim God, whatever, that these are human beings who take something holy and they twist it. So in all of the research that I've done and all of the biblical studies that I have done, and I did my divinity work at Harvard, I have not yet seen an authentic religion that advocates hatred. So the fringe radical group of any religion does not represent really the heart of a religion itself. But, you know, to answer your question in a more intimate way, I was present one night, and I worked a lot of nights, when a young Port Authority officer was speaking with me. It was just a big kid, basically. Looked like a young man. His name was Rudy. The Port Authority police lost more men and women in uniform, I think, than the NYPD. And he said that he was present when some remains of one of the hijackers was found, because I guess they could tell that there was part of the nose of the plane. And I was riveted. I said, you know, Rudy, were those remains desecrated in any way? Were they spat upon, or were they treated in a way that was not respectful? And he said, absolutely not. We treated those remains like we would have any other remains of the deceased. And then looking at me, he said, because we all knew that was still someone's son. That could have been someone's father, and it was not for us to judge. And it really humbled me so much, because I thought, if these men and women who were literally picking through the dirt for, you know, fingers and toes of their loved ones could find the remains of one of the hijackers and still recognize the sacred nature of life and could separate the insanity that we inflict upon each other from that sacredness, then certainly you or I could do the same thing.
That I have to tell you what, that just gave me chills, just goosebumps as you were saying that, and it was just, it's beautiful, and it is, you know, there's that sort of trite, overused repetition of the, I think it was from the Hindenburg, like, oh, the humanity, but really, it's more like, oh, wow, the humanity, that's amazing.
Exactly. Very humbling. Now, you know, the general questions of why, I think they are essential to being human. It's sort of like Kushner's book, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? And those general questions of why, which really cross all faiths, those, I think, still remain. And those remain with people who have lost loved ones, whether to a tragedy like 9/11 or a car accident or a murder or even a long-term illness from cancer. Those questions of why are part of, they're just part of our fabric as human beings as we search for meaning and search for some sort of reason to our days. And how do we reconcile those of us who believe in a higher power with the fact that terrible things happen? So those questions remain, but being specifically against a particular religion, I did not find that at Ground Zero.
Well, now, speaking of that, we have got, again, I mean, the switchboard is just lit up like the proverbial Christmas tree, and so we are going to get to callers in just a moment. First, let me remind everyone that you can call in to talk with Chaplain Rainer, Andy, at 866-Monday-6, Or if you're calling from outside of North America, you can call 347-857-3122. Send us a message by Twitter at Monday Radio, or on Facebook at facebook.com, Monday Night Radio. Or you can call in via Skype and talk to Chaplain Rayner. I also want to clear something up. We got an email from someone who's listening and is waiting to talk to Chaplain Andy on the phone. What I had said was that there was no one responding in our chat area. There are plenty of callers. There are ever so many callers. But there's also a chat area built into the Blog Talk Radio site, and we see a whole bunch of people hanging out there, but no one seems to be talking to us, which is a bit unusual. So we wanted to make sure that the chat system was actually working. So let us go to those callers. Now, callers, I'm going to just ask you to ask your question or make your comment, and then if you can, let Chaplain Rayner, Andy, answer you. You take your answer on the air just so we can get to everyone if at all possible. And first up, we have Joan from Georgia, and I think she has a story to tell us. Hi, Joan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Joan.
Hi, Joan.
You're on the air with Chaplain Andy.
Hi, Joan.
Okay. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just actually wanted to actually make a comment about my particular situation. I was actually married, and 6 weeks later, my husband was diagnosed with leukemia. And basically the entire marriage, he was actually sick, and I was his practically his second nurse. And he died 2.5 years later. And I can remember when he passed away, I didn't, at that time, because I was a Christian, I didn't ask the question why, because I knew the answer to that particular question. And I just wanted to say that some years before that, my mom had passed away, and at that time I asked the question why. I wasn't a Christian at that time. And actually, how I dealt with the deaths were actually different. When my mom died, I had a very difficult time dealing with it. But when my husband died, I had an easier time dealing with it because I was a Christian. And I knew that even though my husband was gone, that God still had a purpose for me and that he had put my husband in my life for that period of time. And we were closer as a result of his illness, and that I had to go on and fulfill my purpose. And I just wanted to share that with the actual listeners.
Joan, thank you very much for that comment. Chaplain Rayner, do you have a response to that?
First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. You must be an incredibly strong woman to have dealt with the loss of your mother and then having your husband diagnosed. So really my prayers go out to you first and foremost. And along with that, I think people of every faith, and I've seen this with hospice, living in the New York area, I've worked with people who are Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, atheist, agnostic, but people who have a faith, regardless of what that faith is, they often will both handle a death with a little less depression and probably with a little more strength and perseverance. And also, if one is terminally ill, if there is an abiding faith, then they also can potentially have a more peaceful passing because there's less anxiety. And I've seen that across the board of you know, almost every tradition. So there is something in us as human beings that yearns to understand that we are spiritual beings encased in these bodies. And it's interesting, when you were talking initially about the question before we started about the GPS and the FBI, I thought if we could put a GPS on the soul and really know and follow where these souls go, then all these questions of religion would be answered. But we can't do that, and so we're really left to our own quests. And again, I think that's an essential part of being human, is to aspire towards knowledge and towards understanding of what it is to be spirit and body. So yeah, I would just affirm what she's saying in terms of her own grieving, is that to have a faith and to interpret it for your life and to interpret the tragedies that happen to us, we can find meaning in our days. But it's really not for us to impose that interpretation on another person. So that just, that's just the first thing that strikes me as I hear that story.
And that makes a great deal of sense. Let's go now to Carl from Philadelphia, who's been waiting for quite a while to speak with you. And I believe that Carl actually has written some on this subject. And Carl, are you there?
I am here. Good evening, ladies.
Hi, Carl.
Hi,
welcome,
Carl,
to Monday Night Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, I actually have written a book about our family's saga, which entailed my losing a brother to suicide when I was 16 and he was 22, and having lost my dad 8 years later because it basically killed him. And, you know, this is a story that I just needed to write. I started to write this book years ago and couldn't find a publisher because everybody said it was too personal. And I kept thinking, you know what, you morons, this is really what it's about. It is personal. And it had a really strong message, which I think at the time people were afraid of. I think that suicide is a subject that has a real taboo about it, and it's been ignored and shunned for so long that the beast has been allowed to grow. And, you know, it's only until recent years, and there's such a spate of kids taking their lives, that this has really become a timely topic. And, you know, I'm glad I wrote the book. In fact, we just added a subtitle. The book is called Bitter Field. Forgive me for rambling, but once I get started, this is really an important subject for me, having lived through it and trying to save other people's lives. But the book is called Bader Field because that's the last place I saw my dad. It's a small airport outside of Atlantic City, which is now defunct, but it still has strong meaning to me and a lot of other people. But the subtitle, which we are literally in the throes of adding to the book, my publisher and myself, is going to be listed as How My Family Survived Suicide. Because I realized that Bader Field doesn't mean a whole lot to a lot of people and they don't know what the book is about, but this is really going to bring it to life. And I guess my message is to anyone out there who's contemplating taking their life, not only do they take their life, their family dies with them. And they take a lot of people, and if they would just realize that there's help out there for them, people do love them, there's always a better answer. Suicide is never, ever, ever the answer. It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
That's a really good way of putting it, Carl.
Well, you know, it's the truth, and it's an ugly event, and a million people a year take their lives, and that is a staggering statistic. And, you know, it's like any other illness, ailment, or disease. It's got to be stopped, and the only way to stop it is through recognition and mass exposure.
Well, Carl, first of all, I'm very, very sorry for your loss, and I'm sure that Chaplain Rayner has something to say as well. But before I take you off the air, what's the name of your book? You have two books, I think, right? Do you want to give the full titles out for both and tell people where they can get them?
Well, sure. The first book that I've written is called Collecting in Care of Fine Art, because first and foremost, I'm a third-generation fine art dealer in Philadelphia in our firm, which is the David Gallery. That book's actually out of print, but I wrote it to dispel the myths of investment and hype and separate truth from reality in the abstract art market, which is really complicated. But the latest book, which is really probably going to be a permanent work, is called Bader Field. It's by Carl David, published by Nightingale Press, and it's available on Amazon. Just do a Google search for Bader Field by Carl David. It'll come up in a million places. But my website is www.carledavid, that's CarleDavid.com, and it's very easily found. It will be available on the iPad, I would think, in the next month or so.
That's excellent. Thank you for raising this very important subject. Pastor Rayner, I have a very hard time calling you by your first name. I'm sorry. I was just raised
not
to do that. But have you dealt with providing solace or grief services to someone who has lost a loved one through suicide?
Unfortunately, as sort of Carl has intimated, it is not an uncommon occurrence. You know, thankfully, most of the deaths kind of over which I've either presided or officiated services for are not results of suicide, but suicide is a very complex issue because you have both the person who has felt such despair or meaninglessness or futility that they are inspired in a, you know, probably in a moment of not really thinking things through, as you're saying, they've taken that moment and to kill themselves. And then you have the family or those who have loved the person who are left in the wake of this act. So it is a very complicated grieving process because families can be left very angry, very guilt-ridden. Why didn't I see this coming? And then general grief of having lost someone that they've loved in such a traumatic way. So suicide is almost its own category, but what it highlights to me is that it really matters how we live, how we die, and how we're treated after we're dead. And all of those things, again, they come back to our understanding of what it is to be human and what it is to live on this planet with other human beings. So, yeah, I again, my heart goes out to Carl, and I think writing about our experiences is very cathartic, very helpful. Talking about our experiences helps remove any sense of shame over having had a loved one who has taken his or her own life. And telling our stories, which I think we'll probably get to, that's a very that theme of telling one's story is very prevalent in any sort of grief work. So suicide is a very difficult thing to survive if you are a family member.
You're listening to Monday Night Radio, and our guest is Chaplain Andy Rayner, and you can give her a call at 866-MONDAY-6. If you're calling from outside of North America, the number is 347-857-3122. You can find us on Twitter at Monday Radio. Before we take any more calls, Chaplain Rayner, I wanted to ask you, let's start with someone who is grieving over a sudden, unexpected loss. What would you say are sort of the top three things that friends and other family members can do to help support them and to provide them some measure of comfort? You know, as the outsider, you're always at such a loss as to, you know, what do you do? What do you say? Because it seems so hopeless and so trite, and the cliches are just that, cliches. And so what would you recommend?
Well, it can be very intimidating if you're a friend who, you know, a friend of someone who's suffered a traumatic loss, because so many of us, we don't want to say the wrong thing, and so we tend not to say anything. And I know, you know, for instance, I had a friend years ago who lost a 10-month-old baby as a result of a SIDS death. And what she found is that because people were afraid to say the wrong thing, suddenly she was isolated, and no one was saying, coming and offering their friendship at all. So I would think one of the things you can do is simply call your friend and say, what can I do for you? Do you need a meal brought? Do you need me to tell people not to bring food? Do you need transportation for one of your children? Or do you need me to pick up your groceries? And sometimes just offering those simple day-to-day tasks that will make the other person's life just a little bit easier is very helpful. And in offering that concrete, can I pick you up a gallon of milk, then a conversation might ensue where your friend will say, you know, I'm really okay with milk, but I just can't stop crying today. And then if you have the courage to be able to sit with that without trying to fix it, because as friends and as compassionate people, we so much want to fix things. And sometimes, you know, the person isn't looking for us to fix anything, but simply to give them the space to share their grief and to share their pain. So the other thing that I would really suggest is that we avoid certain platitudes, even if you firmly believe them yourself, even if this is a very real philosophy for you. I would be very careful to say things like, everything happens for a reason, this must have been God's will, you know, these sorts of things that will assign a meaning to someone's death that may or may not resonate for the one who is grieving. So we have to be very careful to, with the sort of toss-away phrases, even if they're well-intended, because we really don't know enough to say to someone else that this happened for a reason, or this was God's will. So for a friend who suffered a traumatic loss, offer something concrete. Offer the invitation, would you like to talk about it? Or do you just want to go to a movie and not talk about it? Give people options to share as they are able to.
That's such a good point that you bring up, which is that, you know, my heart just goes out to that poor woman that you mentioned, that inaction is perhaps the worst thing that we can possibly do, to not even just call just so that we can let our friends know that we're thinking of them, and to be honest, even just say, I don't know how I can help you, but how can I help you?
Exactly.
Is such great, great advice. So let's go now to Chloe. She's been holding for a while to speak with you, and she is from Washington, D.C., and it sounds like she knows quite a bit about dealing with people, helping people who are dealing with a kind of a long, slow situation. Chloe, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with both of you. I'd like to start with a quote. The author is unknown, but it's a favorite quote of mine. In fact, I have it posted on my refrigerator door. Death is not extinguishing the light. It is putting out the lamp because the dawn has come. I quote that in my latest book because I have a section on the 10 major fears that maturing modern women have, and of course death is one of them. And another favorite anonymous quote on a more humorous side is, everyone wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And I've had a lot of experience with death and dying in terms of my own family members and also as a hospice volunteer. And you know, we have to deal with the subject of death a little bit more comfortably. And when we're ready to do that on, you know, for ourselves, then we're more helpful with others. And, you know, I think one of the most beautiful weeks of my entire life was the week that my mom was dying. And she had been ill for quite a long time. But I had been preparing her a good 2 years before she actually died, and I would talk with her about it. And one day I actually said to her, Mom, I know exactly what's going to happen the day God calls you home. And of course, we, you know, being Roman Catholics, and I have to preface what I'm saying with that remark, because not everybody, you know, would take kindly to it otherwise. And she said, what? I said, well, and my dad had passed away previously. I said, Daddy's going to be at the foot of your bed on the left side. I said, the Blessed Mother's going to be on the right. Your guardian angel's going to be at your shoulder, and they're going to look at you, and they're going to say, Chloe, it's time to go home. And she looked at me, and her eyes got so wide, and she clapped her hands just like a little kid, and she says, oh, I can hardly wait. Well, the night that she was dying, and her eyes had been closed all week. In fact, I would say to her, Ma, open your eyes. Let me see your pretty eyes one more time. And she'd open and flutter, and they'd close again. And like 2 days before she died, I said, how's it going, Ma? And she smiled, and her eyes were closed. She said, I'm getting there. And I said, I knew what she meant, but I wanted to hear more. I said, what do you mean you're getting there? And she took her hand out from under the cover and pointed her thumb upwards and smiled, and I knew what she meant. And the night that she was dying, that last half hour of her life, her eyes were wide open, and she was talking up a storm, but my sister and I could not make out what she was saying. And I said to my sister, we're not meant to see or hear what's going on here. I said, but someone has come for her. And symbolically, I did exactly what I had said to her 2 years before. I had my dad's picture on the left side of the table tray, and I had a statue of the Blessed Virgin on the right, and I had a little Christmas angel pinned above her shoulder on the bed. And, you know, symbolically, I did exactly what I had, you know, described to her 2 years before. And it was beautiful. And then I'm thinking of another, I don't want to take too much time here, but I'm thinking of another case where I was working as a hospice volunteer with AIDS patients. And I went in to see one of the patients that I was taking care of, and I knew he had less than 48 hours to live. And I said to him, "How's it going, Ken?" And he smiled, and he says, "I've got 1 foot in the water, and it's feeling just fine." And I just loved that. It just complements everything that I believe in. So we really, we need to read and get familiar and get comfortable with the topic of death, even in our own lives. And, I'm 73 years old, and I know I've lived the bulk of my life. And so each day could conceivably be my last. But that's okay, because in the meantime, I'm living each day to the max. And that's what I wanted to share.
Well, that was absolutely beautiful. And I really, you know, one of the things you highlight, thank you for that call, Chloe. One of the things I think you highlight is that I think often people who are facing death are less, they're not as scared as the people around them. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that is often the case. I can recall many times, as a hospice chaplain, going into a family and the family would say, "Look, you know, please don't tell Mom that you're from hospice. You know, she doesn't really know that that she's terminally ill, and, you know, turn your badge over so that she can't see that you're from hospice." And I would go into the bedroom and the patient would say, "Look, I'm dying, but please don't tell my family that I'm dying. I'm, you know, there. I don't want to startle them. I don't want to scare them. Can we just have this between you and me?" And so, you know, the work, which was really beautiful and satisfying, was then to try to get the family to begin the dialogue, the types of dialogue that Chloe was speaking of and had done so beautifully with her mother. So often the person who is sick and or dying has a sense of what is happening within their body, and they are beginning to prepare. But it's not always the case. There is a very large part of us that cannot conceive of our own finitude, even when we are very, very ill. And it would be wrong to then impose that reality onto a patient who isn't ready to hear it. So we have to be careful. And as I always say to people when they ask me, you know, how do I talk to my children about death? I will offer some suggestions, but I'll always say, you know your own children best. What my children can handle, kind of growing up with a home where death was always a topic because their mom was a hospice chaplain, they would handle death in a different way than, say, a family that subject was more taboo. And similarly, if you have a loved one or a friend who is terminally ill, you have to go with what you know with that person best. Is this something that that you can invite dialogue with the person? Should you wait until they bring it up? You have to kind of go with that instinct and with the part of you that knows and loves them best. And just tiny little anecdote from my own life. I had a grandmother who lived to the age of 106, and she was very, just a very strong Kentucky woman, very straightforward. And as her life began to wind down, she was getting to be more tired. She was a woman who never used a cane or a walker or a wheelchair, and certainly had all her faculties. As she was, you know, getting more tired and resting more, I had a cousin who came and sat with her and said, "You know, Grandma, it's really okay to go. You know, if my grandmother, she thought, was sleeping. If you want to go, you know, just go. You've been here a long time." And my grandmother opened one eye and said, "Relax, I'm not there yet." So, you know, sometimes we kind of impose our you know, what we think is going to be peaceful. And, you know, she wasn't there yet. She had always said, look, I want to linger. I want to get my last 2 cents. And you know, I teased her. I thought she was taking advantage and doing more than lingering. But who are we to ever say that someone should be ready or should be making peace or should be accepting the fact that they have a limited lifespan? We have to be very careful not to impose our desire for their peace onto really where that person is spiritually and emotionally.
That's such great advice. I want to go to a caller now who has been waiting. Again, they're all waiting very patiently. But this is someone who has a special connection with you. I don't know that you guys know each other, but she was also at Ground Zero working as a psychologist, and she's really wanted to get on and talk with you. So, Dr. Judy, are you there?
Yes, and what a beautiful show. You are both so amazingly empathic, which is what people need at times of loss. I'm just listening here rapt and ready to cry over what's going on the air here and how the love that's being spread. And as you have just said, indeed, I did work as a mental health volunteer at Ground Zero. And over the years, it's now been 9, I've been very upset each year that there's less attention paid to the memorials. I have a band called Stand Up for Peace Project, and every year we play at the UN Chapel. We played, and we've had all these songs we wrote, the Towers of Light, about the two towers that went up. And it bothers me so much that people have let that go. And there will be something perhaps for the 10th anniversary, but some people want to put it aside. I understand that as a psychologist, but for me personally, I know I need to share. And so thank you so much for letting me be on the air to share, hearing you and connecting with you, because I don't see too many people who walked the pit as I did and handed out water and comforted a lot of the rescue workers and suffered with some of my own pain as you did for 5 years. I remember just being so involved in that it overtook my life, and I did very little else at that time than really helping at the Family Assistance Center. And I've suffered with so many of my own losses, my brother's suicide that you all were talking about earlier, and working in Haiti right after the earthquake. And I think as the bottom line, there's so much to say, is that it's made me think, as listening to you on the show and just how beautiful you're hosting it and how beautifully you're speaking about it, is just how important it is to love people who are still with us.
Well, thank you so very, very much. I really appreciate that. Chaplain Rainer, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I mean, first, I am obviously very grateful for the mental health workers who were on site. It was always kind of a strange experience to have someone from the mental health field actually come up to me or to one of the chaplains and ask how we were doing, because, you know, the role there was to be a presence. And so it was very startling and touching to have that turned around and have someone really ask how you were doing. The thing that I would be concerned about, and this is, I think, for those of us who are in helping fields, is that there is a phenomenon called compassion fatigue. And while our, you know, a field like hospice or end of life or disaster relief is very gratifying, and it's an incredibly inspiring profession. It's obviously one you don't go into for the money, but you go into it for those greater rewards. But what can happen is that we can start to get very fatigued in that caregiving. And for those who work in disasters, going from one disaster to another, it almost begins to be, you're almost on that gerbil wheel going around. So I think the self-care, whether you're a family member who's taking care of a chronically ill or a terminally ill family member, or you're someone who is in a helping field, it's very important to kind of check in with your own spirit. And one of the ways I have done that through my life of basically 20 plus years of services is to kind of realign my spirit and to remember that I'm not in this work to be some sort of do-gooder in the world or to be you know, somebody's Superman, but rather when I'm interacting and sort of interfacing with a person in need, I'm also incredibly honored and humbled that they would allow me into their life at a very intimate and very difficult time. And so as caregivers, if we can kind of open our hearts and our minds to the gifts that the other brings us in terms of their stories, their experiences, their trust, then it becomes a circle. What we are putting out is returned to us tenfold in the honor of being present to one in pain. So I think I'll just offer that out to Judy, because obviously she's doing incredible work, is to remember that circular flow of energy, that then when we are really in the zone of being where we need to be, we are putting out love and compassion, and something is being returned to us, even if it's a difficult life lesson. We're kind of rehearsing our own tragedies with each person we encounter, and kind of getting that trial run to see how that feels as we are also being empathetic and compassionate.
And just before we go to a couple more callers, I wanted to ask you, I've given you enough time now, I hope, to think of the three things that that you would say, you know, to someone who is supporting someone who is going through sort of the pre-grieving and extended grieving of caring for someone who or watching someone sort of deteriorate through a long illness and then dealing additionally after that with their death. And I know that sort of, you know, the conventional wisdom is that in some ways it's a relief because you don't want to see them suffer and now they're at peace and all those things. But nonetheless, it doesn't really feel right to go up to a friend or family member who has just lost someone under that circumstance and say, hey, I bet you're glad they're out of their pain now, huh? I mean, that's
obviously
not the best way to support them.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you have a friend whose family member is still alive and they're terminally ill, I would think, you know, a couple really good questions are, how do you feel? Because people, especially if it's a, you know, women, we're probably more, that's a more exercise muscle, I think, is that we tend to be talkers. And if we have a girlfriend, just say, how do you feel? And if you're asking that, make sure that you have the patience and the courage and the compassion to sit and hear those feelings, which can be upsetting and sad for the listener. So how do you feel? What do you need? How can I help? Those are the types of questions I think that are very important. I don't know if we've mentioned this yet, but I am a breast cancer survivor myself, and so I kind of had the tables turned on me in many ways 3 years ago, where I went from someone always helping to someone suddenly in need, and that was a very strange experience initially. I found it difficult to begin to accept the care that my friends and family were so willing to give me. But those friends of mine who said, you know, do you really want more flowers, or can we channel that into a WIG fund? Do you need the meals that are coming, or would you rather have a gift certificate to a local restaurant? Those kind of practical questions I found very helpful. And then those who were closest to me, who would say, you know, what is this like for you? How are you feeling? Those genuine questions. Now, if you're not close to a person, that can also be very upsetting. I remember a colleague that I had who I didn't even know very well, who came supposedly to visit me and asked if she could see my head without my wig on. It was so invasive. And so strange. You know, well, can I see, you know, your hair loss? Well, no, you can't see that. And it's just bizarre what people ask you. Now, you know, if you're present with someone who has just lost a loved one, again, to somehow refrain from imposing your own interpretation of that death on the person, and simply saying, you know, I am so sorry. I know that sounds like it's not saying much, but if you say that in an empathetic way, I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm here for you. Those sorts of comments, rather than God doesn't give us more than we can bear. While maybe that's true, that is not the right time to impose that on someone who's freshly grieving the loss. So I don't know if that's answering your question, Anne.
No, it was wonderful. That was and made so much sense. And I think that's something that, we tend to lose is our common sense, because we're so afraid of saying the wrong thing that we just don't even think about, well, what would I want someone to say, or just what are the things that make sense to say?
We get nervous. And I'll just say one last thing, and that is William Sloan Coffin, who was the great preacher in Manhattan at Riverside Cathedral, lost his 23-year-old son in a terrible car accident in Boston. This is years ago. And he had many of his parishioners coming and bringing food and hugging, and physical contact and those hugs are just so healing. But he also had a few who would say to him, well, you know, God, this must be God's will, Pastor. You of all people would know this must be God's will. And this would absolutely infuriate Sloan Coffin, and he later wrote about this and said, we never know enough to say that something is God's will, especially for another person, but rather that God's was the first of all of our hearts to break the day that my son went into the Boston Harbor. And so to somehow connect someone to the reality of a compassionate God rather than one who sort of whimsically imposes tragedy on some and spares others, I think is really so much more helpful.
That absolutely, and such wisdom. Thank you for raising that, and what a story. We are not going to be able to get to all the callers, and I apologize, but there are just so many people that have things they want to say, and we have limited time. So I want to make sure to tell everyone, if we don't get to you, please submit your question or your comments to our email address, which is comments@mondaynightradio.com, and we will forward them on to Pastor Rena. That doesn't mean that she's going to be able to answer them, but certainly we will make sure that she gets them, or if the comments are for us, then we're, of course, looking forward to seeing them as well, even if it's just like, gosh darn it, I really wanted to talk and I didn't get to. I've just never seen it look like this. Yes.
Well, I think if they are interested and they want to go on to my website, it's www.RayNor.com. And I believe there's a spot there where they can, I'll have to look at it, where they can submit a question or a comment. They can sign the virtual guest book, and I will then be able to respond to them. So, again,
excellent.
It's RayNor.com, or you can also Google my book, The Voice That Calls You Home.
Which is also available from Amazon, and all of that information will also be up on our website. So if you don't catch it here, you can certainly catch it through the website. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Pat.
Can we just get
one or two more callers very quickly? We have about three minutes left, and I want to bring Sandy on, calling from Washington. Sandy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Hi.
I realize we're short on time. In a nutshell, I'm a grieving mother and an author. I wrote a book actually on the topic of this show, and my experience comes from losing my firstborn in a car accident, so that was a very sudden death. And then I lost my fourth child to childhood cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
So I have both. I have the night and day, and I can say, for me, the differences were profound. When I lost my son, it was sudden and immediate, and my arms were empty, and, I struggled for years and years with all of the whys, hows, and the empty arms. When my baby died of cancer, because of the long treatment and being in ICU for 55 straight days and surgeries and chemotherapies and everything, I was grieving the entire time. So, yes, in a way, it was easier to start my grief journey because I was already grieving. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it's easier, but they were night and day differences on how I lost my children and how I grieved. The one thing that I got out of it, though, that I wrote a book because of, was everyone saying, I don't know what to say to you. I don't know what to do. I do not know how to help you. And that
Sandy,
was...
Sandy, What's the name of your book? I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'd like to let you get that in, and we have 45 seconds. So what's the name of your book so people can find it?
BecomingBiggerThanOurPain.com. We'll take you to the web.
Becoming Bigger Than Our Pain. Excellent. BecomingBiggerThanOurPain.com. That's Sandy's book. And then Reverend Andrea Rayner, and her book is The Voice That Calls You Home. And you can find that on Amazon. And you can also look her up at her website at RevAndreaRayner.com. Reverend Rayner, thank you so much for joining us. Will you come back? This was wonderful, and we clearly have lots of callers who'd love to see you.
Thank you so much, Dan. Thanks for having me. And thanks, everyone, for sharing this story.
Oh, thank you very much for everything that you do, and we look forward to hopefully having you back.
That sounds
next
great.
Week,
thank you.
Get organized. You're welcome. Next week, get organized with organizing expert Linda Samuels, who's going to give you tips on how to get your life organized.